From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made on a Sunday afternoon with a bike ride. A renowned local cardiologist taking what he calls a quick 20-mile ride in Canandaigua before an evening barbecue with his family. He was an experienced cyclist, often taking 100-mile rides around the Finger Lakes. The date, May 30th, 2009, a day that would change his life forever. Dr. Bradford C. Burke, the then CEO of the University of Rochester Medical Center, was blasting down a hill, one he had ridden 100 times before, when he saw a white station wagon driving toward him. It was taking up the entire road, and what happened next is harrowing. What I'm about to read next are Dr. Burke's words about the accident. Quote, "I quickly realized I couldn't go around the car without flying over the guardrail and tumbling down a deep ravine. At 30 miles an hour, I couldn't slow down without hitting the car head-on and being thrown onto the windshield. So I tried a mountain bike maneuver. I shifted my weight back and skidded the rear tire around to try to slide under the car. As I gently squeezed the brakes and started the skid, I felt myself being thrown over the handlebars. I heard a loud crack and landed headfirst on the ground. I learned later that the skid caused my rear tire to blow, which made the bike wobble and nearly stop, sending me forward. I noticed instantly that I couldn't move my legs or my left arm. When I tried pulling my right arm underneath me to push myself up, it too stopped moving. I could tell that my neck was broken. Even worse, I was panting, which meant my injury was probably above the fifth cervical vertebra, since that part of the spinal cord contains the nerves that control the diaphragm and breathing." End quote. Dr. Burke was airlifted to Strong Memorial Hospital. He writes about the accident and about his recovery in his new book entitled Getting Your Brain and Body Back, Everything You Need to Know After Spinal Cord Injury, Stroke, or Traumatic Brain Injury. It's a book written for people with acute neurological injuries, with advice about medical care, mental health care, technology to assist in recovery, and a lot more. Dr. Burke's recovery has progressed far beyond the expectations of his medical team, and it continues today. He shares his story, his experiences as a doctor-patient, and a message of hope in his book. He joins us today to discuss all of that, and again, the book is out now. Dr. Burke, a board-certified cardiologist, distinguished university professor in medicine, neurology, pathology, pharmacology, and physiology, and physical medicine and rehabilitation, the founder and director of the University of Rochester Neurorestoration Institute, and author of Getting Your Brain and Body Back. That's the only time I'll do your full title, all of them. It's wonderful to have you here.
It's great to be here, Evan.
Let me just start by asking how you are today. How are you?
Great. Beautiful weather. And I did a big bike ride yesterday, so any day that's sunny is a good day.
Well, and we're going to talk about the work that you've done to put yourself in position to enjoy a bike ride and to do the work that continues to give you the quality of life that you have, because certainly in the late spring into the summer of 2009, I am sure there were lots of doubts that you had about quality of life, despite being the doctor that you are and the person that you are who has been in this system for so long. All of a sudden, you're the patient. Did you have doubts about what life was going to be like?
I couldn't tell for sure. All I knew is that I was going to work as hard as I could every day to make as much recovery as quickly as possible. So, for example, there are only 5 or 6 places in the United States where you could start rehabilitation while you were on a ventilator. And I knew the sooner I started my rehab, the less muscle mass I would lose. And so I went down to the Kessler Rehab Institute in New Jersey because they were the closest place that enabled you to do rehab on a ventilator. And that's a difficult thing to do because you're coughing and moving and choking. But I started exercising right away, and that, I think, made a big difference.
We're going to talk quite a bit about mental health, everything from post-traumatic stress disorder to impact on quality of mental health and ways that anybody in these various positions can maybe think about how they plan their own recovery. For you, how important was the early decisions you made to try to rehab quickly, to get moving as much as you possibly could, and to determine that you may even go back to work as CEO. I mean, how important was that mental health approach that you had?
Very important. You know, this was by far the most adverse circumstance I'd ever faced, but I felt, you know, my brain was fully functional, and my left big toe, I could wiggle. And my neurosurgeon said that was a good sign. And so I said, I'm going to go and begin this rehab as soon as possible, and I'm going to try to get off the ventilator as soon as possible. And I would set these goals for 1 week or 2 weeks at a time. And the more often I was able to achieve it, the better I felt. There were some things I couldn't do. You know, I couldn't eat for quite a few months because the nerves that controlled the swallowing were among the last to recover. So that was actually a pretty difficult thing to do. I was not eating any food at all for about a month and a half. And so some things you looked at as very depressing, other things you looked at as very positive. And in the book, I write a lot about resilience, which I think is a key property for people who are in these situations.
Certainly. I think there is perhaps an assumption that with paralysis, well, at least there's the lack of pain. But unfortunately, as you describe it, you had significant, your eyebrows just went wide. You had significant pain at times very acutely. And I think that probably will surprise some of your readers who might have had that feeling that, look, you've lost so much, but at least there isn't pain, but there was pain.
Yeah, pain is an interesting feeling. It comes when you have a neurologic injury in many different ways. So a lot of people have heard about phantom limb pain mm-hmm. when they have lost a limb, yet it still hurts and their brain still thinks it's there. And certainly spinal cord injury is one of the situations where there's a lot of that. And as your body is recovering, you get all kinds of strange tingling sensations from your nerves. And you develop what are called hyperesthesias, so you feel more than the normal person. And so anesthesia is what puts you to sleep. That means no sensation. And today, for example, my left leg has anesthesia. It doesn't feel things. But my right chest is very sensitive. If you just gently rub it, it hurts. Sends this big signal to my brain. So the brain interprets what kind of signals it's getting from the rest of your body. And unfortunately, pain is one of the most primitive signals. It's critical for your survival if you're in trouble to feel the pain. And so when it can't substitute any other sensation, it frequently chooses pain.
I cannot think of anyone better positioned to have handled the trauma that you've gone through and to now deliver to the public a chance to offer a sort of roadmap. Who did you write this book for?
I wrote it for primarily people who have one of these neurologic injuries. I wrote it for their families and their friends and also for caretakers. It's really targeted not at doctors, although I hope doctors read it because there's a lot of evidence-based medicine in it. When I wrote the book, it took 5 years. I read about 150 books and about 5,000 articles to really find out what's true and what's not true. And so it's really my scientific self-discovery of what works and what doesn't work so that people don't waste their time doing things that aren't going to help them and that they focus on both medicines and on rehab therapies that do make a difference.
I mean, I say this just as plainly as can be. I can think of two people in my life right now that this book would have been an absolute godsend and a roadmap for them had it been available when their own injuries happened, one a traumatic brain injury. The book is called Getting Your Brain and Body Back, Everything You Need to Know After Spinal Cord Injury, Stroke, or Traumatic Brain Injury by Dr. Bradford C. Burke. It is out now. And this is an injury, a change in your life that leads to a kind of grief. And I want to talk a little bit about that. When you talk about phantom, you talked about phantom leg pains and dealing with change, whether it's the loss of a limb or a brain injury, a spinal cord injury. There's a sort of a cycle of different emotions you may go through. So in 1996, I was just hospitalized briefly. I had a catheter ablation for Wolff-Parkinson-White syndrome. And Dr. Burke knows immediately what that is, I'm sure. It's just a little heart condition that was taken care of. And I felt very fortunate. But I happened to be in a room with a curtain, and the person on the other side was someone who had had a leg amputation. And I remember one time him calling out my name, "Evan, Evan, are you awake?" And I said, "I am now." And he said, "I went to give myself a bath. And my leg wasn't there." And he started laughing. And he said, "I've got to laugh at it, got to laugh at it." And I have often thought about him because that actually did two things for me. I kind of got out of the woe is me attitude because I thought I haven't, you know, everything is relative. But I also, it made me wonder throughout the years if that was sort of a defense mechanism early, if he would, because I don't know what happened with him, where he would go in terms of the mental state of dealing with this change. You write that it very much is a loss and that there is a grieving process that people should be prepared for. Can you talk about that?
Sure. So in the very beginning, I think almost everybody either is depressed or anxious. And PTSD, which is the probably post-injury mental health disorder that's best known, is actually a form of anxiety. And I had PTSD. I got very anxious at certain times. I was very nervous about people moving me in certain ways. And I think that those two psychological mental health problems really make a difference in terms of how you respond to the loss of your former life. And if you're very depressed or very anxious, it's hard to deal with that because you don't have the mental resources available to deal with. And so people frequently have prolonged grief and they think for many years about what should be or what could have been versus what is. And I think that makes it very difficult. And so just like you would grieve over the loss of a parent, you are grieving over the loss of what your life used to be versus what it is now in reality. And it's hard to face the reality. And as I said, people who are resilient, who have the ability to draw on other resources they have, those people tend to do much better and get through the grieving process. Having a family, I think, of support makes a huge difference because they grieve with you and there's comfort in having people to share those experiences with. And so there's an inevitable grieving process, but I think most people who are successful draw on these community resources, draw on their own internal resources, and to some extent are able to acknowledge that there's been this fundamental change and that they have to work their way through it over time. And time is the key thing. As children, you know, we bang ourselves and we're all better in the next day. These three kinds of neurologic injuries change you in a really profound way. Because the nervous system covers every part of your body and determines every single how every single organ works. And so people who have these injuries, it's much more complicated than having your gallbladder out because that's one organ and everything else still works okay. But here, everything doesn't work properly. And so you can get upset one day and grieve for the fact that you can't feel things very well. So you can't hold a pill because unless you look really hard at it and try to grab it, it'll drop right out of your hand. So you could grieve about the loss of sensation. Or you watch a little baby stand up and walk, you know, from along a sofa, and you think, I wish I could do that. And we go back in time to when we were younger and carefree and didn't realize that you could hurt yourself so badly.
You practiced lifting plastic wine glasses thousands of times and then practiced another 1,000 times with increasing amounts of water in the glass. You write, quote, that was all before I was able to try lifting real wine in a real glass, end quote. But you had some breakthrough moments where you were able to do what you couldn't previously. Can you describe what that was like, having some of those little breakthrough moments? Yeah. They're not little. They're big.
They're big. So feeding myself was a big thing. Early on, I was hell-bent, if I can say that on the radio.
You can.
Hell-bent to learn to walk again. And that's really what a lot of people with these injuries are focused on, walking again, because it's a vision of your return to normalcy. Mm-hmm. Being in a wheelchair or in a power chair is immediately obvious to people that you've had something happen. If you can walk, then people can't choose you, can't categorize you as someone who's paralyzed. But it turns out that for you, the person, being able to eat by yourself and not have people cut up your food and feed it to you makes a huge psychological difference. And so those are the moments that I think are remarkable, when you can finally pick up a fork or cut with a knife. That's incredibly satisfying that you've managed to get to that point. And drinking a glass of wine, for me, I have a wine cellar. I like wine. And it really loses something when you're using a straw to drink your wine. It's not quite the same thing. So being able to pick up a glass and drink it normally was a huge thing.
You're right that practice is critical for that, though.
Yes. To become an expert, you have to practice 10,000 times. And particularly after these kind of injuries with paralysis, you have to retrain your brain. So I was right-handed before my accident. My right hand is much weaker than my left hand, so I had to become left-handed. And I knew that I had really made the transition. When knocking something over, I would instinctively reach with my left hand to catch it, where years before I would have reached with my right hand. And so that kind of, we call it plasticity, neuroplasticity, the possibility of remolding the way your brain works is very much possible, but it does require an enormous amount of repetition to make it instinctual.
It's neurorestoration is the notion of the brain essentially rewiring itself by building new connections between nerves. Is that pretty scientifically grounded now? Do we know more about that now than we did?
We know a lot about that. So the example I best like is stroke. And strokes very commonly happen from your carotid artery, the main artery in your neck. And one whole side of your brain goes down if there's a big clot there. So you're paralyzed on your entire right side. And in the effort to fix that, the right side of your brain turns on about 1,000 different genes. And we can actually measure those in both people and in animals to see what exactly those genes are. But the most profound insight is that the good side of your brain, 5 times as many genes change, 5,000 genes change. So the uninjured side is trying to compensate for the injured side. And we don't understand that. How does it? What can it do? But it's clear that your entire brain gets activated when you have an injury. And there are ways to measure how much oxygen and how much sugar the brain uses, because those are the energy sources. And we can measure those in real time. And we can see that areas of the brain that prior to your injury would have been quiet now are more active. And the more that you improve the use of something, the brighter those signals get. Mm. So the brain is a remarkable tissue. Everyone thinks that, you know, brain cells, they die, there's no recovery of them. And that's where stem cells come in. But even without stem cells, the existing cells that you have can rewire themselves. And there's a famous scientist who coined this phrase, nerves that fire together work together. And so as you do all these repetitions, the same nerves keep firing together and firing together, and they form a team. You can read in the newspaper about, you know, Tampa Bay Buccaneers. They won because they're more united as a team. And I think that that's true of your brain. It has to work together as a team for all of it to enable you to perform complicated functions.
I found that section, that's very, very hopeful for people who are going to be facing this sort of a road of recovery. And if I could, I'd like to close the loop a little bit more on PTSD and pain, and note your thoughts about what is sort of, I mean, every person's different, but what people might expect or what might feel overwhelming. You wrote that you were suffering from symptoms of PTSD about 18 months after your initial injury, but there were several times in the first 6 months where you felt like you were re-experiencing the shock of the accident whenever you felt unexpected pain. You wrote, quote, "Once when a nurse was using a lift device to transfer me from my chair to bed, I felt pain that shot up my arm into my shoulder. Without conscious thought, I screamed as loud as possible. I started swearing and then began to sob uncontrollably. Similar reactions occurred every month or so during the first 2 years after my injury. But because these reactions occurred so infrequently, I didn't talk to my doctor," end quote. And you go on to say that PTSD should be treated aggressively because it can be associated with other maladies, cancer, arthritis, digestive disease, cardiovascular disease. How do you kind of associate something with PTSD and distinguish that between a typical reaction to either pain or, you know, sort of grief? And how do you aggressively deal with PTSD?
So as you heard from my own story, it's hard to know it. And I think one of the things I've tried very hard in the book is to make it clear that mental health is very much shaken by this change in your physical health. And that admitting and having someone help you makes a difference. And so I actually recommend that almost everybody should get put on an antidepressant, because it takes quite a long time for those to kick in. And if you're depressed, you're not going to try very hard in rehab. And the most critical time for rehab is right at the beginning. And so very important that we look, and that doctors are aggressive, and that you can't diagnose yourself, but you certainly can sit down with your doctor and have a discussion about, you know, what can you do to test me to see if I'm having mental health problems? And the easiest way I can diagnose it is hyperreactivity to situations. When suddenly you just get overwhelmed by some situation, and it's like every part of your brain is trying to shout about it at the same time, and you just get extremely emotional. And for me, you know, that was like venting as hard as I could. And I think that everyone has their own unique way. Some people become somnolent and just won't get up or move or do anything. Some people laugh, like your friend. And all of these are emotional outpourings of some inner stress.
Kind of a coping?
It's kind of a coping, but on the other hand, it's also it's very dysfunctional, right? To get so upset, then it takes a long time to get unupset. And what's interesting, for example, if you have a spinal cord injury that's above the sixth thoracic vertebrae, then the system, the fight or flight system that we have, the sympathetic system, can get overactive. And your blood pressure during one of those moments can go to 250 over 150. You can have this enormous surge of adrenaline that is not compensated for. And people actually can get strokes and hemorrhages in their brain from that. Mm. It's called autonomic dysreflexia. Big word. I just tell people, just think of it as the fact that your fight or flight system so dominates that you are running as hard and as fast and as scared as possible from the biggest tiger you've ever met. That's what PTSD feels like. You're running from something as hard as you can, and or you've seen something that's so terrifying that you're scared, or you've seen something that's so sad that you're sobbing. All of those extreme emotions, for me, are part of what PTSD is.
You also write about pain, that part of six components of good treatment plans for psychological needs. You know, you want to consider different medications. You don't want to wait. You want to get the mental health therapy you've talked about. But then when you're dealing with actual pain, there's concerns about that people have with addiction. Substance abuse can be common with ANI patients. And your own views on opioids, for example, I think are interesting. Can you share?
Yeah, so I have two different views on opioids. So first, they're remarkably good at controlling pain. So for people who have really bad chronic pain, I think if your physician administers the opioids and you use them properly without overusing them, then it can be a good medication. You'll be addicted if you continually take them, because the brain adapts, just like we've been talking about, and it'll take you quite a while to withdraw from the opioid. But there's nothing wrong with being addicted if it's helping you enormously. And they tend not to make you as sleepy as some other meds. Me personally, I wanted to get off the opioids because they have a lot of side effects, the biggest one being constipation for me. And the addiction is a problem because the fewer meds you're on, the better you feel psychologically. And once you're on an opioid, it's hard to get off them. So I think it's a personal choice, but on the one hand, they are effective drugs. On the other hand, because they're addictive, many people can't stop using them. And I think that dependence on a drug is psychologically harmful.
Are they overprescribed?
They have been, for sure. OxyContin, for example, I think everyone knows that, you know, there was an enormous push for people to go on those meds. So that one certainly has been overprescribed. We've all heard about how some of the long-acting opiates can cause problems when mixed with heroin. And so they've become street drugs. And I think that makes your family leery of what's going on if you're taking a drug that you read about in the newspaper. And so I think my overall recommendation is to avoid them if possible. There are many different kinds of pain medicines. And for example, exercise is a terrific treatment for pain and much healthier for you than taking opioids. So I would say to someone, go through the list of 5 or 10 ways to treat pain that I talk about, and only if none of those work, consider taking an opioid.
Talking to Dr. Bradford C. Burke, who is the author of Getting Your Brain and Body Back, Everything You Need to Know After Spinal Cord Injury, Stroke, or Traumatic Brain Injury. Dr. Burke was the CEO of the University of Rochester Medical Center in 2009. Well, he was not just in 2009, but when the accident happened. And listeners may remember the accident that happened, but I think I was surprised to hear it had been 12 years. Time moves quite a bit here, and I would have said 5 to 7 years. It was, of course, a big story in our community, and Dr. Burke has done such important work for a long time. The book is very direct in certain ways. I mean, it is very honest about his own experience. We've been talking about his PTSD, pain management. We'll talk about Eastern medicine in just a moment here. But it's also very direct about what to expect and how recovery is still possible in different ways here, maybe in certain ways that you hadn't even considered possible. I learned so much just about some of the subjects we've been talking about this hour, the way the brain works, the way the brain forms connections. The book is very direct about the accident, the bicycle accident that led to his paralysis and now his road back. And I think this book will help a lot of people. And I admit, I think I was surprised about your views on Eastern medicine. If I could read a little bit of what you wrote, quote, "I'm a board-certified cardiologist and a biomedical scientist. From my medical training and experience as a doctor, I hold a long-standing faith in the value of what we call Western medicine. But since my spinal cord injury, I've learned that there are tremendous benefits to be found in Eastern or Asian medicine and complementary medicines and therapies." You read about your time in Nanjing, China, with Dr. Li as the most profound healing experience you've had to date. Did that surprise you that you'd be sitting here writing a book praising Eastern medicine?
Very much so. And my connection with Dr. Li is pretty unusual. He actually is recognized in the United States as a preeminent biomedical scientist, which I didn't know. We have an elite organization in the U.S. called the National Academy of Sciences. There's about 600 of the best scientists across the board who are part of that. And he is a foreign member. And what he actually worked on is control of the heart in people with spinal cord injury. And as I mentioned earlier, this cutoff at the 6th thoracic vertebrae makes people who have injuries above that a natural model to study for how the heart functions and the body functions. And a good friend of mine who was a researcher in my laboratory was in Nanjing, and he was an orthopedic surgeon. And he told me after my accident that I needed to come there and meet Dr. Li. And Dr. Li had a son who was in college here at Case Western Reserve. I have a lot of family members there. We arranged for him to meet me at my uncle's house. And one day he came and asked me to do some things for him, the most simple-minded of which was going from sitting to standing. And he had some remarkable ideas about how I could do it better. And he said, "You have to come and give us a long time, and we'll make a big difference in your rehab." So I did. I took a sabbatical. So universities are nice. Every 7 years, they let you take a year off. I'd never taken a year off, so I decided this would be a good year to do that. And so I went there and spent 3 months. And what I learned is really that there are some skills in terms of meditation and in terms of massage and acupuncture that when done properly have an enormous benefit. And one of the goals of the Neuro Restoration Institute is to actually bring some people over from China and to teach people here who are interested in some of those methods. And a lot of it's the practitioner, just like in Western medicine.
Sure.
But conceptually, I think they have mastered putting all these elements together. It's not just the massage or just the acupuncture. It's the combination of how they do it and doing all of them. And I was doing 6 hours a day of therapy there, and that makes a big difference as well. So I think we try to rush through everything. So, you know how when you're doing a circuit in the gym, the first few times you do it, you might spend an hour, and after several months, you're doing it in 20 minutes.
Oh, sure.
And so I think that's a big difference in China. So I went there in 2012, and then I went back in 2014, and some of the people who were in therapy the first time I was there were still in therapy the second time. And so it is a dedicated effort. And the therapists there are very dedicated. And I think one of the other differences is that the ratio of therapists to patients is much higher in China. Mm. We can't afford in our medical system to have a lot of rehab specialists just because of the way the insurance and the like works. And it's unfortunate. But in China, the family members can take off, and there are more people in the hospital doing rehab than here. So there are some differences in the way medicine structured there that also enables them to do, I think, a more profound therapy. So in addition to the therapies being different, I think the number of people who are involved in your rehab differs. And so when I was there, my aide was there, my wife came and spent some time, and we built a community of people helping me get better altogether.
The word holistic is sometimes a buzzword that's just used for marketing, but this is a real holistic approach. And I wonder what your Western colleagues think about your experience.
Well, they're always interested to hear me talk about
it. Are they open-minded?
They are. So there's a concept called mindfulness, which is being aware of the moment in a non-judgmental way. And that's become a very popular concept in Western medicine. And in Oriental medicine, in Asian medicine, it's been there for very, very long times, the concept of being mindful and putting yourself into a meditative state that permits you to be very mindful. And I think we're just now really coming to understand the value of those kind of mental exercises.
Meditation about 15 minutes a morning for you, is that right?
Yeah, I'd say, just like I was commenting, you cut it down over time. So I actually meditate now for probably 5 to 7 minutes, but I have it extremely well done, so I can get into a meditative state very quickly, and it's refreshing and makes the start of the morning much easier, I think. That transition from bed to chair to moving around is a lot harder for me than for the normal person. And that transition is vastly easier if I've been meditating and have my mind clear. That clarity helps you to focus on the transition.
Let me read some feedback from listeners. This is from a listener who asked to remain anonymous, who wrote, quote, "Not to be dismissive of Dr. Burke's recovery, but please keep in mind that the hundreds of thousands of dollars that have gone into this recovery, the type of care that was immediately available to him, access to rehab at some of the best facilities in the country, and the different accessibility devices that make his life what it is today possible, and the myriad of caretakers that attend to certain needs are not available to most spinal cord injury patients." So this listener is not at all disputing it. In fact, I think this listener is saying, can we build a world where what's been available to you is available to everybody? And has this opened your eyes at all in any way to accessibility of medicine, whether it's cost or systems, et cetera?
Yeah. So Melissa, you are spot on. As I just finished saying, one of the problems is American medicine does not provide the safety net for people with these disabling injuries. And it's makes me very sad all the time. I actually have benefited from being a physician, so I know more readily how to access and, quote, work the system. And I can tell who's really good and who's not, which has enabled me to find high-quality caregivers. So I've been very fortunate in being able to rehab. And in the book, I talk a lot about continuous rehab, which I think people can do. It's not costly. So I talk about what I do every day when I'm at work. So I have a standing frame. It doesn't cost that much to purchase one that enables you to stand upright for as long as your blood pressure lets you do that. And that's a terrific rehab therapy to be standing. Makes your whole body work because man was designed to stand. We're one of the few creatures that stands. I do a little bicycle that I can drive my wheelchair up to and pedal to nowhere for an hour. That exercise is great. It costs $99 for that little bike. And I do train all the people around me in how to stretch me so that my muscles don't get tight and contract. And those are very cost-effective forms of rehab. So a lot of rehab can be cost-effective. The thing that people need is a good prescription in the beginning so that they know what they should do. And that's the biggest problem we have, is that not everybody gets a comprehensive evaluation and prescription. And I was able in the beginning to visit a number of doctors and therapists and get a lot of opinions on what people thought would be the most productive way for me to recover. And the book, I tried to write down as much as I could how you should go about doing that. And in many places I say, you and your family need to ask your doctor, ask your caretaker about this, because this is an important thing that you should have access to. And the book also has a large number of resources in ways to access the healthcare system in a not-so-expensive manner. And the United States, to its credit, we passed the American Disabilities Act back in 1990. We are probably the most disabled-friendly society in the world. China, for example, despite all the goods that I talked about, you almost never see someone in a wheelchair out. People are socially awkward when they see someone in a wheelchair. America is a much, much better place where, you know, we have installed door openers all over the place. We have ramps everywhere. You know, streets didn't used to have cutouts when you got to the corner. And if you were in a wheelchair, you were doomed. And now you'd be shocked if you ran into a place in a city that didn't have a cutout for you to go. So we're quite fortunate here to have a very accessible society that is also capable of providing resources to most people.
You do travel a lot. And do you find travel, I mean, certainly travel is, you know, more difficult for you than it would have been pre-2009, but is it getting more accessible, and do you see advances, or do you still see big gaps?
I wish I could say that the better has been as dramatic as some other things. It hasn't been, because it is costly to make things accessible, and it's not used that much. I think that I probably travel more than the average person with a disability. And because a lot of people, when you travel, you're out of your normal routine, and people get sick, people don't feel well, they don't sleep well. So traveling is difficult. And I try to limit my travels to maybe 3 trips a year now, just because it takes me so out of my routine.
Mm-hmm.
And with all the cutbacks that the travel industry has had to undergo because of COVID-19, I think for the next several years, travel is going to be harder. There are a lot fewer people able to help you. And in all honesty, the most important part about accessible travel is having people around that can help you. And there aren't that many people now because of cost.
Yeah. Let me read some more emails. Patrick says, great conversation that's very applicable for anyone who's ever been physically hurt. This type of information is empowering for any athletes and for any person suffering chronic illness and the relationship with PTSD. Sometimes it doesn't have to be anything big to trigger stress response to a physical malady, past or present. Benjamin writes to say, this is a truly inspiring program. Thank you. I damaged my spine in the service, and I've had multiple neurosurgeries to repair it. Can the doctor please briefly discuss motor and sensing neurons? And if you regain one, what does that mean for the chances of the other returning? My motor neurons began working a few months after my final surgery, but I still cannot feel the right side of my right hand or my two right fingers.
Sure. There's no doubt that there's an intricate link between the motor and the sensory systems. So we have specialized receptors for things like temperature, pain, touch. One of the most important ones is something called proprioception, which is where your limb is in space. That's what the police are testing for when they ask you to do your finger to your nose. I would fail that under basal conditions because I don't have the nerves that sense position. The good news is that by exercising motor, that stimulates the sensory system. And I think over the next 5 years, we're going to see some amazing devices for people that have difficulties with their motor and sensory systems, where the device will stimulate your motor system in a way that's very similar to normal. And the devices are smart enough that after stimulating the motor, it will pause for a second to get the feedback from your body of what the sensation was, what happened. And we didn't have devices that were smart enough to do that. And now we're beginning to develop those. And what's happening in the most remarkable cases is the device helps someone learn to walk again. And then after 3 months of using the device, you can turn the device off and the person still can walk again. It's truly remarkable. Mm. And one of the most profound parts of my own experience in China was they made me walk every day. And over the course of the 3 months I was there, my right leg started to regain some sensation. And so I think that there are dormant nerves that get reactivated when you start using them. And so motor can lead to sensory recovery. Physically in the brain, they're right next to each other. So it's known that there are intricate connections between the two. So I think that we'll see devices now that take advantage of that.
David wants to know what Dr. Burke learned about bedside manner and whether you have changed at all if and when you are treating patients.
Right. That's a great question. Bedside manner is about 1/10 of the issue. The other 9/10 are the culture of the place that you're in. How compassionate are people? How attentive are they? I talk a lot about that in the book. And when I came back to the medical center, I started a new program called Patient and Family-Centered Care. And the pillars of that were compassion and attentiveness. And what I tell everyone is people who go into healthcare are compassionate people. That's why they're doing it. They have an innate ability to be compassionate. But they don't always know how to be attentive to the patient's needs. They frequently get boxed in to the medical part. Oh, we've got to do this first and then this and then this. When the patient's telling you, I really want to do that. That's what I really want to get better at. And so you have to be attentive to what the patient wants. So I think I'm much more focused on that than previously. And also in terms of compassion, I think we wanted to be reserved, to try to be dispassionate, so the patient wouldn't think we were biased in our decision-making. And I think that's wrong. I think we should show the patient that we're compassionate and that we do feel this approach is better than that approach. And it's the classic, if it was your mother who had the problem, what would you recommend? And so I think the change wasn't so much in me, but in the system. And I wanted to be part of a system where those values, compassion and attentiveness, were high in this in the scale of importance. And we actually put together this into something called the I Care values that were integrity, compassion, awareness, respect, and excellence. Those five make a big difference, I think, if you think about them every day.
About 30 seconds. What gives you the most happiness these days?
Helping someone else. So the book, I really put my heart and soul into this because it's the way I can help the most people. I can't talk to 500 people a day, but if 500 people a day read it, then I'm helping a lot of people. And as we said at the very beginning, this is designed for a lot of people. Anyone who has paralysis, which in our society is a large number of people. And as we get older, stroke becomes a more common disease. Mm-hmm. And so even though I have a spinal cord injury, I put as much effort into this to help people with strokes because there's so many more strokes than there are spinal cord injuries. And so I hope people who have a stroke will take the time to read it as well.
Someone with stroke, spinal cord injury, brain injury, there's so much. And so many listeners right now know someone, if it's not themselves, they know someone in this category. And this book is very much a roadmap. It's called Getting Your Brain and Body Back. Everything you need to know after spinal cord injury, stroke, or traumatic brain injury by Dr. Bradford Burke. It has been an honor to have you, and you are truly an inspiration. Thank you.
Thank you, Evan. It's been a good experience for me. And I hope for those out that you've enjoyed the presentation and get to read the book.
Well, the book is available where you find books, wherever books are sold now. Thank you, Dr. Burke. Thank you to the whole team today. Megan Mack, producer, Emma Ray Stein, production assistant, Rob Braden, engineer. I'm Evan Dawson, and I hope everyone listening has a peaceful weekend. We're back with you Monday on Member Supported Public Radio.